call the meeting of the House Committee on Rules to order for Wednesday, February 19th, 2014. And I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 4134. Erin, can you please review the measure and the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4134A directs Youth Development Council to allocate funds available to support community-based prevention and intervention programs and services based on indicators of need for youth aged 6 through 20 years old, requires allocation to take place by public process and be reviewed biannually. Allocation process becomes operative July 1, 2015. It creates a Juvenile Crime Prevention Funding Committee to make findings regarding funding issues, recommend changes to policies and practices adopted by the Youth Development Council, and report to the Legislative Assembly on or before January 1, 2015. The committee sunsets June 30, 2015. You have a dash A8 amendment. It changes the composition of the committee to include 7 members appointed by governor, 2 persons who shall be members of the Youth Development Council, 4 persons to represent counties appointed with consent and approval of Association of Oregon Counties, 2 of whom are directors of juvenile departments, and 1 person to represent tribal governments. It designates the legislative administrator and Oregon Department of Administrative Services as committee for as staff for this committee. There is a subsequent referral of the Ways and Means, so we do have a fiscal light and a no revenue on the dash A8 amendments.
With that, Speaker Kotek, please identify yourself for the record.
The committee. Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, and Speaker of the House. Pleasure to be here today. I'm here to speak to the dash A8 amendments, but just briefly, when the bill was first introduced, as you could tell from the quick summary, it is about defining how we continue to serve the most at-risk youth here in the state with the existing resources we have. I also know that some of the changes in the underlying bill caused concern, so when we moved it out of the House Ed Committee, it was amended with a delay of the implementation of the application process that would be going forward in terms of making sure every county had a minimum grant to serve the most at-risk youth and then have an application process for the rest of the dollars. That has been delayed to the start of the next biennium. That was the biggest issue in the last amendment that came out of the House Ed Committee. We also created a work group that was mentioned that would look further into how juvenile crime prevention dollars are being used, particularly for those youth who have been connected to the juvenile justice system and trying to intervene so they don't return. And I think we don't have complete clarity on how all the dollars are being spent, but I'm very much committed to that work group that you see in the bill that you have before you, and I have an amendment to further adjust that work group. But I think we all share the common goal of making sure we have good outcomes for those youth in our state that are suffering from a whole lot of barriers, whether they're school-related, whether they're substance abuse-related, whether they're juvenile justice-related, and that is the overriding goal of the bill. So the dash A8 makes changes to the work group to add additional members who represent counties. The original bill that you have, the A and Gross that you have, had 2 legislative members. That stays the same, but instead of 4 members of counties, you would have 7. You'd have two people who would be members of the Youth Development Council, and then 4 people to represent the counties, 2 of whom shall be directors of juvenile departments appointed upon the recommendation of the Association of Oregon Counties. And because we're talking about also providing grants to the tribes in the state, we'd have 1 person to represent tribal governments. While there was some concern about the process that brought us this bill with regard to the Youth Development Council, we also wanted to clarify that this would be a committee supported by Legislative Administration and DAS, not the Youth Development Council, to make sure that it's an independent group looking at the items that it's being charged to look at and coming back with recommendations before the next session. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Oh, excuse me, Madam Chair, the goal would be hopefully to amend the bill with dash A8, moving on to Ways and Means without recommendation, but please amend it. That would be helpful.
Are there any questions? Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Speaker, thank you so much for bringing this bill. I suspect I'm not alone in this, but I have been hearing concerns from my county, and those concerns take the form of, we have a good program in place, don't pull the rug out from under us. And the numbers are, you know, nearly 5,000 people served, youth served since 1998 through 2013, 91.5% of at-risk had no criminal referrals in the 12 months after that. So it sounds, from what you're telling us, that the amendment and changes in the bill are going to minimize the threat of something like, of our pulling the rug out from under good, highly functioning county programs.
Madam Chair, Representative Harker, I do believe the amendments, both in the Angros and the ones you have before you today, are to address the concerns that have been raised by counties who previously or currently receive a dedicated formula based on the number of 0 to 18-year-olds they have in their county that go to juvenile crime prevention. What this initiative is meant is to take all existing dollars for at-risk youth and try to target them. I believe that proven programs in counties who are currently getting funded will continue to get funded. I think it just requires a community process, further consideration. It guarantees money for each county, and I think this is a very valuable conversation. But I will recognize that the speed at which we are trying to implement this change caused concerns, and that's why you see amendments in the last iteration and this amendment as well.
Now, it's my understanding that with the changes in the Dash 8 that the Association of Counties are neutral.
Madam Chair, I won't want to speak for them. I hope they're here to testify after we move the bill out of House Ed with the now the Angros version, that I believe there was some level of support from AOC, but I would want them to speak to that themselves.
Yes, and we will call them up to clarify that after we're finished.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, and that maybe is my question. I had some discussion with some folks about it. Their concern was that we were going to be essentially taking money away from some of the rural counties and putting it more in the metropolitan area, and that constitutes a significant shift. And with modest resources in rural areas, having a very disproportionate impact. And maybe we'll hear about that and whether that the Dash 8 addressed that adequately. I don't know.
Madam Chair, Representative Kenemer, my belief is the way the bill is written now, and the additions are primarily around on the committee that will look further into some of this very specific ways some of the money is being spent and make recommendations, which, whatever those recommendations are, I'm willing to consider them and hopefully move them if they make sense. Every county and every tribe will have a minimum grant. I would argue if a smaller county, through a community engaged process, can demonstrate they actually have more need, they might get more money than they're currently getting.
I hope so. Thank you. Thank you for your answer.
Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Speaker. Thank you for coming down personally, too. What's the problem we're solving?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I think the broad problem we have in the state is we have many at-risk youth throughout our state who aren't graduating from high school. They have substance abuse issues. They are becoming involved with the juvenile justice system. And so we have a problem. We have a lot of kids in need, and we have limited resources. This bill that came to you in the original version that is now evolving resulted from a longer conversation with the elimination of the State Commission on Children, Families, and the local commissions. We divvied up dollars to the early learning side in the 0 to 6 range, but there were also a set of youth dollars that were under the State Commission that were serving at-risk youth, you know, 6 to 18-year-olds. And we all know there aren't enough resources there. So what we asked the Youth Development Council to do in a bill we all passed last session was go look at all the dollars we do have, figure out a way we can best get the best outcomes and serve as many kids as possible. This isn't about that there's a problem in the juvenile crime prevention world. I believe some of those juvenile crime prevention programs are outcomes-based and have been, you know, well-serving that set of youth. But we have what this would do is actually combine $6 million of youth investment funds, $6 million of juvenile crime prevention dollars for a pot of $12 million, guaranteeing minimum grants to each county, and the ability to apply based on community-engaged process, based on the needs in your community, to say, we need this to do X. I think there are a lot of good things happening in the counties. I think those things will continue to get funded. This just says you don't have a guaranteed funding formula just based on the population in your county.
Yes, Representative Berger.
One more question, and thank you. So more money is being brought into the system for this particular youth population. Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, not exactly. What I'm saying is the existing funding streams will be integrated so that POT will say, of all the youth needs out there, communities should get together, decide what they need, and then apply to the state. There will be more dollars globally and probably more targeted. But what I like about this the most is an opportunity. We haven't had a conversation about this population of youth since I've been in this building. This bill is actually really producing a very important conversation about youth who aren't graduating, youth who have barriers to success. If we're successful here and we're all on the same page about where we're going, I think we can go ask for more money in 15-17.
She's raised another question. Okay, where's the measure of success in this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I would refer you to the House Education Committee materials from last week, and I'm happy to make sure they get online. So the Youth Development Council had a financing plan directed by us over the legislation we passed last year that explains that. There's also two tables online there as well that says, here's how we used to be doing it. Here's how this would move forward differently, specifically talking about outcomes. What I like about what they're proposing is it is based on need with specific outcomes. What's great about the juvenile crime prevention programs is that they actually have been using an assessment tool that allows them to understand what the youth are facing when they first come into their programs and where they are when they leave their programs. I can't say that every youth program in the state is using that assessment tool. One could argue that assessment tool for JCP programs provides them an advantage to continue to get funded because they actually are looking at outcomes entering and leaving. So I don't know if that helps.
Well, that does help because that is what I have heard, is that by broadening this, you're losing that targeted outcome-based program and diffusing it into community bases without that kind of metric that is measurable. You're basically taking, this is what I have heard as criticism of this particular proposal. Well, you're taking this targeted, outcome-based, metric-heavy program and taking the money and diffusing it out without that kind of metric.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I think it's a matter of perspective, but what I would say is, these programs, the ones who've been doing it well, are the models that we want the other dollars that are being spent in communities to follow. So I actually think they are leading the way. What it is saying is we want to combine these dollars, put everybody in the room and say, how do we best serve these at-risk youth in our community? And the programs you can show they have verifiable outcomes, and that's a lot of the JCP programs are already doing that. There's nothing keeping them from getting more dollars into those programs. Now, you have to go and have a community conversation, and I think that's where we want them to do. And any change in process, I understand, causes nervousness. But I think there's an opportunity here to do things even better than we're already doing.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else? Thank you very much,
Thank you.
Madam
Appreciate
Speaker.
Your time.
Janet Carlson. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, I'm Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner, and with me is Patrick Singh from the Association of Oregon Counties. So we had a discussion. Well, originally we took a position in opposition to 4134, the original bill. The Association of Oregon Counties did, for many of the reasons that have been discussed in the last few minutes. We brought back the Dash 4 amendments. Those are the amendments that were integrated in that created the A and Gross version. And on Monday took a position in support of the A and Gross version with several elements that we wanted to continue working on, and provided that information to the governor's office and to the speaker's office. And they have been supportive. Part of that was the Dash 8 that you have in front of you. So we were concerned about the composition of the, I guess it's called a committee, and wanting to make sure that there were more county representatives, that the Association of Oregon Counties had a role in designating who served on the group, and that the staffing was from a body that was not associated with creating the funding plan. that resulted in the original bill. So all of that is wonderful. One of the things that you'll note, and I don't have a copy of the Engrossed in front of me, so Patrick is giving me an electronic version. In the Engrossed version, it changed back the word. I'm trying to see where it was. I have it on the dashboard. In the original bill, it changed the word county to community in a couple places. And so it said that, okay, so it would be on the original bill, page 2, line 9. Where are we? Page available. Okay, so it's line 16 on page 2 of the A Engrossed. In the original bill, that said that there would be a minimum grant for each community and tribe. And so what that, the way we interpreted that, was that if communities applied for grants through the competitive process, each of those communities would get a minimum grant. Mm-hmm. That means that you could have 5 or 10 communities from the tri-county area, mm-hmm. and you would have a lot diminished chance of the smaller communities being able to be competitive and to be able to have grant writers and so on. By changing that back to county, what we've been assured is that every county now will have a minimum grant. And so that was also a large movement back. We understand that the funding plan still needs to be aligned at the agency level with the legislation when it comes out. So we'll be watching to make sure that that occurs. The last issue I would think that we need to continue working on, and we will work on this as it goes to Ways and Means, is just on the scope of work of the committee itself. So there are some tasks that are listed in the bill that the committee will look at. Some of those tasks we believe are, when it talks about recidivism versus prevention, or what, you know, what goes for juvenile crime prevention, what goes for recidivism. We had a really extended conversation in the House Education Committee, and I think it was Representative Gorsuch who talked about how part of the confusion is how we define prevention. So when some folks think about prevention, they think about primary prevention. That would be mentoring programs and after-school programs. But when you're talking about the target population for juvenile crime, prevention has meant youth who are at imminent risk of going into the juvenile system, and it has the risk factors that are associated with that. So this is a much smaller, more targeted group of youth that have been the recipients of these funds. Also, it can mean that a youth after first arrest is already in the juvenile system, but you want to prevent that youth from going more deeply into the juvenile system. And so prevention is not prevention is not prevention. And as you know, there's primary, secondary, tertiary prevention. We could get into all that. So I think one of the things that we would hope is that the committee would not be limited to the topics that are listed in the bill, literally as they're listed, but that could have that discussion about clarifying what target population we're talking about, how prevention is defined, how we make sure that the youth that have been benefiting from these services continue to benefit from these services. And we believe that we can do that perhaps with a small tweak, and we could do that in Ways and Means. So that's
the final thing we're
concerned about.
Thank you. Questions?
So at this point, you're satisfied with the bill and you're anticipating the tweak in Ways and Means. Is that another way to say what you said?
Representative Hoyle, Representative Kenemer, AOC has taken a position in support of it with the changes that I described, yes.
With the anticipation that that would occur in Ways and
Means. Right.
And
this is a portion of the change, and we're looking for
yes.
a few additional changes to occur, but we're still negotiating those.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, wait. Sorry. One more question. Representative Holby.
Just a question. I probably could ask this offline, but I'm kind of curious about the AOC process for support or opposing. Does that mean that there's a consensus among counties in Oregon, or what exactly does that mean?
Representative Coyle, Representative Holby, that's a wonderful question. As you know, 36 counties do not always agree on everything. We have a process in the Association of Oregon Counties where we have steering committees, and the steering committees review. So this bill was, the Dash 4 amendments were reviewed by the Human Services Steering Committee last Friday. and then that is forwarded to the Legislative Committee. The Legislative Committee is made up of representatives from counties, but not every county is represented on the Legislative Committee. We require a 60% affirmative vote in order to take a position. It's not a straight majority. Or is it two-thirds votes? Two-thirds vote. So it's a higher threshold. Even when AOC takes positions with a two-thirds majority, there will be individual counties, because counties are run by independently elected officials who may have other points of view than AOC, and that is perfectly normal, and we live in that reality. So,
just a quick follow-up and just a quick question. Do you communicate to your counties the position AOC has taken to all your counties?
That position, I believe, was sent out by email to commissioners and judges. We also have a newsletter that goes out regularly. I can't guarantee that every commissioner reads their email or their newsletter, but we make every effort to get the information out.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Well, thank you so much.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 8 Amendment to House Bill 4134.
Vice Chair Hovey moves to adopt the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 4134. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4134 as amended to the floor without recommendation, and the measure be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Hovey moves House Bill 4134 as amended to the floor without recommendation, and the measure be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Yes.
And I guess I'm wondering, without recommendation. Because I don't recall
because
that discussion. And nobody had that discussion with me, or at least if they did, it's lost in the memory somewhere.
That's what the speaker requested.
Yes.
Ah, sometimes there's densicity.
I think I heard that.
Speaker Kotek. Colleagues, for the record, Tina Kotek, House District 44, State Rep, Speaker of the House. I think because there was a very long conversation, House said, if you want to have that full conversation, then I think it would be more appropriate to then decide if you want with or without recommendation. I just understand that we moved the bill here because we want to make sure this we got the committee correct before we send it to Ways and Means. And we really appreciate the extra jump through your committee, but we also know you haven't had the full blown. Unless you would like to make with recommendation, happy to take that. I just understand that you've just seen the Dash 8, and I've only talked for 10 minutes when I gave a half-hour testimony in the other committee. So,
thank you. Well, yes. There are wiser folk.
Representative Hicks.
Often when, either in this committee or others, when there's an indication that there's still some work yet to be done, even when the trajectory is on that course, I'll flag it for the Ways and Means folks by voting no. And so that's going to be my intent today, to flag it, not to pronounce one way or the other on the bill, but to flag that it sounds like there's still additional work to be done so that they'll at least see that.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Yes.
We did have a commitment that there would be additional work in Ways and Means, and with that assurance, I'm going to support the motion, although I do have concerns about and would prefer that we send it did the work and more recommendation. And I guess an editorial comment, if I may, this is an example of why I'm learning to dislike the short session, is I think we ought to do our work in the committees in which the bills reside and get it right instead of trying to catch up along the way. And thank you for the editorial.
Representative Berger.
I appreciate the words of the speaker in saying without recommendation. It says that she understands there are still issues around this, and Ways and Means certainly needs to weigh in. So I will support this motion.
Okay. Good.
Great. Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have too many concerns with the bill to support the motion today, whether with or without recommendation. I find that the Ways and Means, at least in my opinion, is an inappropriate forum for this particular bill. This committee would probably be a better forum, but the Ways and Means Committee is, though I know better than this, having some history in the building, is not really supposed to be a policy committee, and the things that are being discussed are going to, of necessity, be policy decisions, not financial sort of decisions. So I would have some, you know, serious problems in relationship to that. I have some other problems, though, if this is going to the Ways and Means and these problems haven't come before this committee that I would like to address, at least to make some sort of brief mention or overview of them. One of the things as I read this bill, it in these community areas, it calls for a community or a county or something, a committee, and has a whole laundry list of areas that they notwithstanding may come from, not having to necessarily come from. In some of the counties that, at least one of the counties that I represent, and maybe in all three of the counties that I represent, that can be something of a major burden for them. And I say a major burden for them because they have a limited number of people with some of the types of expertise that are being talked about or looked at. Here. And with that limited number of people, most of those folks, or many of them, are seriously stretched in their performance of their existing duties. As much as I appreciate the local flavor that is brought in with this, but to add to this without some way to alleviate those situations for these communities, I find that to be difficult, and would question their ability to be able to stay on top of all of the issues that they will need to be familiar with. And that has no reflection negatively on the quality of the people in these communities. They're the best people on earth. The three counties that I represent have the best people on earth. And I beg your pardon,
well, we may
for
have
all
to
of
dispute,
the other
have
counties,
a few disputes here.
You know, and since I'm already announced as I'm not a candidate for re-election,
what?
That is not a campaign speech, certainly. At any rate, Madam Chair, to stay with things that are more germane, I think this also, the nature of this is that one of the troubling things, I hear the term minimum grant. I haven't had a definition of what a minimum grant is. I've looked through what little material I've been able to find on this to see what that minimum grant might be. And maybe someone can enlighten me, the speaker can enlighten me what a minimum grant might be. But where the personnel are not available, the minimum grant is going to be the maximum grant. My hypothesis, unless somebody is a real workaholic and wants to put a lot of time, hours, and energy in, and I'm sure there will be people that do that. As a consequence of this, I see the bill as being something of a continued, and we're talking some serious dollars here if I read the material I have. What, something in the neighborhood of $20+ million?
No. I'm happy to clarify about that, Ethan.
Okay. But had some things sewn out here. It looked like I'll take that back. 19.7, I guess, is what the material I had. Be that as it may, I'm glad to listen to what the other dollars might be. But I see us in rural, and I hate to ride that pony too far or too long. I've been riding him now, though, for 18 years, and I have at least destined to continue to complete the 18 years doing that. I see some of the rural counties being significantly disadvantaged in relationship to this. I have a question as to with where we're at right now, and I haven't been able to get information other than a question as to whether the tribes around the state have been at the table as this issue has been discussed. I do understand that the Umatillas have sent a letter basically supportive, and the Umatillas would be the tribe that is in my district. And they would be supportive of it, but from what I read between the lines, they read that there's some money that's going to be there for them, and most of us would be supportive of anything that would offer us some money. At least, if you don't, you can try me, but, I would generally be supportive of most anything. So that's the tribal input. And since I do have a tribal input that I need to be aware of and concerned about, I would say that I think the Umatilla tribe is very the Confederated tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation are very progressive and are very, very concerned about the education of their children and about the well-being of their children. However, they will certainly be there to admit this. When I look at the performances of the children coming off of the tribes, they are below the state norms as such in their performing capacity, and I would be seriously remiss if I didn't support anything that would help them move beyond that, because their elders and tribal councils have been working very hard to address many of these issues. So I'd like to have had get a little more input, and I know there are a number of other tribes out here. I could go on, Madam Chair, with a number of things with this, but I really would rather see it, the issue resolved in a policy committee. And I know, as Representative Kennemer has pointed out, I think others have pointed out, that the Ways and Means is going to have a lot of these policy decisions to make. And I shudder a little bit at the confusion of roles that those of us who happen to be on Ways and Means sometimes in my experience are fine.
And just to your first part of your comments, questions, the minimum grant now is $50,000 and it would go to $70,000. So, and Speaker Kotek, did you have other clarifications?
Madam Chair and Representative Jensen, I appreciate your indulgence. I really appreciate the comments, Representative. I would love to sit here all day and talk about this, because I do think it's a really important bill, but I also know it's tough when you're getting handed these random bills. I do think we're very close to getting this bill done. I imagine there could be some changes. I'm open to them, but I think they will be minor, because the major issues were how fast we were trying to do this and this kind of, we need another conversation about how these dollars are being used in a certain way, although you've heard some suggested changes. But I think you're seeing generally where the bill is going with the amendments today and the amendments last week in the House Ed Committee. But I have to say, because if people are watching, this bill does not change some very key elements of our programs now that we serve at-risk youth. We already have community-based planning. A lot of the groups that you mentioned, that's existing statute. We expect counties now to designate an agency and a set of community partners to help put a plan together. That doesn't change. That's what the law is now. We haven't changed what we target, how we define the at-risk population. That's still in statute. That has not changed. We guarantee a minimum grant to each county. That is currently the norm. It's how that gets the dollar gets determined is changing. Formula versus grant application. And that we're really focused on outcomes. That is the case now. It'll be the case going forward. So I'm happy to send my testimony from House Ed with some of the documents so people can read more. This is a really important conversation, and I'm glad we're actually having it. And I think this bill moves us in the direction, and we're trying to respond to the concerns. But thank you for your questions.
So with that, are there any more questions, comments, concerns? Let's not go with concerns. Question or comments? Okay. So the motion has been made to move the bill as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference, and I would ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Harker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Representative Kenmer?
Aye.
Representative Smith-Warner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hitt?
Nope.
Vice Chair Holding?
Aye.
Chair Hoyle?
Aye. The motion passes. And I'll close the work session. And with that, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4155. Erin, can you please review the measure?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4155 authorizes Public Employees Retirement System Board to establish procedures for recovering administrative costs from participating public employees for providing to those employers information or services needed to report in compliance with generally accepted accounting principles. There is an emergency clause on this measure. There is a no revenue impact. A fiscal statement was issued. This is the measure that we introduced as a committee two Thursdays ago on the day I like to refer to as Snow Day.
Okay. With that, I would like to call up Paul Cleary and Gary Blackmer. Whoever sits down first should identify themselves and start testifying.
Chair Hoyle, members of the committee, I'm Paul Cleary, the Executive Director of PERS. As Erin indicated, House Bill 4155 would allow us to recover the administrative expenses associated with providing newly required pension liability data to our 900-plus employers. Governmental Accounting Standards Board has created new standards both for pension systems and for the employers who participate in those systems. This now is going to require us to provide comprehensive, audited, individualized data to each of our employers for their financial reporting that starts June 15th in the year after June 15th of 2014. So we have to get started on this this year. Really, this is just a kind of a housekeeping bill. It's an administrative efficiency and cost effectiveness measure. The employers are required to report the detailed information in their financial statements. It's just a question of how can we do it in the most efficient and cost-effective manner possible. At the PERS, at the system level, you can kind of view this as we already bake the loaf and audit the loaf at the system level. We just need the authority to slice it up and give the individualized data to each of our members. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Mr. Blackmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Gary Blackmer, Director of the Secretary of State's Audits Division. The Government Accounting Standards Board has been moving more toward increased accuracy and precision and reliability in pension reporting nationally. And as part of that, they're requiring that the pension liabilities be reported in the financial statement, which means they need to be audited. And so this is a new requirement that every government that participates in person
PERS in Oregon needs to report on their financial statement. If this bill does not pass, then each of these 900-plus jurisdictions will have to get their own audit of the PERS statement of their liability, which would add a substantial amount of cost for them to issue RFPs, to monitor, and to pay for those individual auditors to essentially duplicate work that could be done in a more centralized way. So from a timeliness standpoint, from a public service standpoint, these organizations, these government agencies, can save money by reimbursing PERS for that single larger audit that gives them the information they need to report on their financial statement. If I urge you to move this on, and if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Government Accounting Standards Board, whose authority does that operate under?
The Government Accounting Standards Board is appointed by the Financial Accounting Forum or Foundation, which oversees FASB, which is the corporate side of it, as well as GASB, which is the government side of it. So it's got appointees on the GASB board that come from local and state and federal government in order to provide consistent accounting practices. So it's an independently funded organization that all of the accounting firms recognize as setting standards for accounting.
And could I follow up? I don't think you quite answered my question.
Okay.
I'm trying to figure out what authority they have, where they get their authority from. I think what you said is that they get their authority from working as a standards board for somebody, but I don't know who the somebody is.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes, they are recognized as the standard-setting body for accounting by all of the accountants, essentially, in the profession. So it's collectively agreed that this board will agree upon how financial information is displayed in financial statements and how categories of accounting are laid out. So it would be say engineers or the medical practice where you have the American Medical Association.
Yeah. Then final follow-up, if I could. So this board standards, Rule 68 or whatever it's called, would be used in the process of establishing bond ratings,
right?
And the willingness of bond counsel to sign off on a bond underwriting as a part of their regular practice in the private business of placing and rating debt. Is that an accurate statement?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Barnhart, yes, that is the bond rating agencies and bond counsel want to see that your financial reporting is compliant with generally accepted accounting practices, and the GASB 68 standards are part of that.
And then a slightly different topic, and then I'm done. One real quick question. This looks like a really efficient way of getting this particular job done. Is this the most efficient way to do it?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Barnhart, yes, we believe it is the most efficient way. Again, we already collect the data at the system level. We do auditing at the system level. This now allows us to slice that up and deliver it to the employers and recoup those costs.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Okay, Representative Barnhart.
I'll be very quick. If an agency is, I just want this on the record, if an agency is not a PERS agency, they are still subject to these, and they will have to find a way to conform to these GASB regardless of PERS.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Berger, any local government jurisdiction or governmental entity that wants to go into the financial market will have to comply with these, whether they're part of PERS or not.
Thank you.
Right.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger and Representative Barnhart, one other consequence is that federal funding is not necessarily going to go to entities that don't have clean audit opinions on their financial statements. So that's another consequence besides borrowing ability.
Any other? Yes, Representative Holby.
Thank you. I'm curious how they recover their administrative costs now, or do they?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Holby, we have not been required to provide this kind of detailed information until these new standards were adopted just in the last 2 years. So the first year that we have to provide it is the year beginning after June 15th, the fiscal year after that. Prior to this, we only had to provide what was the required contribution for PERS. We didn't have to slice up the liability. At the system level, we always showed the system-wide liability, not the individualized employer data. So it's a new requirement, and we don't have the statutory authority to collect and expend those funds. We do have budget limitation for it. For the first year, our estimated cost. Now, we just got 210 pages of implementation guidance on this a week ago. So, you know, we're in a little bit in the dark here, but I believe we're covered for a year.
Yes. And I'm sorry to, I guess, exhibit my ignorance of this, perhaps, but you're collecting this from the participating public employers, according to the what I'm reading. And so, is that a extra cost to these participating employers, or is it replacing a cost they currently already have?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Holby, again, they don't have to provide it now, but they will next year. So what they're doing is avoiding the cost of doing that individually and having us do it collectively. So it'll be an increased cost compared to what they paid in the past, but it'll be the most efficient way to meet that cost, and it'll minimize it as well.
And one final, I'm reading on, and so these costs are paid out of the interest on the PERS contributions that the employers are making?
Chair Hoyle, Representative Holy, that's right. Right now we fund our administrative expenses off of interest earnings on the fund, and this would just be another slice of that we do.
Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Just a question here. Who are these governmental non-employer contribution contributing entity? Governmental non-employer contributing.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Jensen, I'm not sure what you're reading from what we have here in the bill. It says administrative costs recovered under this paragraph may be recovered only from interest earned on employer contribution.
I'm reading from the GASB,
GASB
we've been talking about. How the changes in this statement will improve financial reporting.
Right.
The requirements of this statement will improve the decision usefulness of information in employer and governmental non-employer contributing entity financial reports and will enhance its value, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Ah.
That's from GASP.
Private pension.
Huh?
No? No, probably not. Not in this standard.
And I see in the material, if you look under, you know, anywhere looking up GASB,
yeah, right.
A number of references to this non-employer contributing.
Oh, thank you. Chair Hoyle, Representative Jensen, that could be for some of these pension systems where they've got an entity that is actually paying some of the contribution cost. Say they're directing money out of a certain tax receipt that it's a non-employer contribution. I'll give you an example out of California. CalSTRS is the teacher retirement system. The state of California contributes money to the teacher retirement system, but they're not the employer of the teachers. The state employees are actually in a whole different system in CalPERS. So it would be that type of arrangement there. you know, you're contributing to it, but you're not an employer.
I understand the California.
Okay.
Yeah, and we don't do that.
Yeah.
In Oregon.
Yeah, right.
Well, I...
Right, our contributions all come through the employers. Now, the state, through the school fund, contributes money to the cost of education. Some of that obviously comes back, but the contributions come directly from the employers.
The example of California is what's being
covered. Thank you. That triggered my thought.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Thank you so much. So
thank
we
you.
Have two more people to testify. Testify, Rob Bavette and Carol McCoog. And if you would just come up and testify to those things that have not already been said, that would be great. That you think are still necessary, and don't worry about reading your testimony. Just hit the highlights.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was going to keep it really short, and now I'm not going to say anything other than this. The alternative is to send 900 sets of...
Please identify yourself for the record.
Rob Bovette, the Legal Counsel Association of Oregon Counties. The alternative is we send 900 sets of auditors to PERS to each bake a loaf, and that's not efficient. So let's not do that. So please pass 4155.
Excellent testimony. Top that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carol McCoog. I'm a partner with the law firm of Hawkins, Delafield, and Wood, and we serve as bond counsel to numerous local governments as well as state agencies. And I'm currently serving as the chair of the Oregon Municipal Debt Advisory Commission. The Oregon MDAC is in support of 4155. I don't know if I can beat the speed of that testimony, but a number of issues have been raised already or earlier in the testimony regarding the effects of not complying with GASB on the ability for local governments as well as the state to borrow money and issue bonds. I will just reiterate that certainly not having a clean opinion from an auditor is a red flag for investors and may deter investor interest in bonds, as well as provide a factor for rating agencies potentially to downgrade or provide a lower rating for bond issues. I also would like to mention that in the federal SEC report on municipal securities market that was issued in 2012, the SEC has encouraged all local governments and issuing governments to comply with GASB as a uniform way of reporting financial information to the public securities markets. So thank you, and I will entertain any questions that you have.
Any questions? Excellent testimony. That actually did help clarify things, so thank you so much. And with that, I want to close public hearing on House Bill 4155 and open up a work session on House Bill 4155.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4155 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Holvey moves House Bill 4155 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the motion passes, and the carrier...
You want to
do Representative Holvey, or Representative Berger?
You want it? You got it.
Carried the last one. Representative Berger.
How come I can't carry it?
I'll carry it.
I want to go. Will you?
Yeah, sure.
All right, Vicki wants to do it because she just can't. Representative Berger. And next one you get. Okay.
If you want it, you can.
No. So Representative Berger will be carrying the bill just in case there was any lack of clarity.
Well, if I could, Madam Chair, this is the kind of issue that the Revenue Committee regularly works on, and Representative Berger is very familiar with these kinds of problems.
That's exactly why I picked her as the carrier.
And I raised mine, and I volunteered.
That and 30 other reasons you're not going to explain.
I'm just going to close this work session on House Bill 4155 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4156. Aaron, can you please review the measure?
And
And amendment.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4156 authorizes Department of Human Services to appear as party in juvenile court proceeding without appearance of Attorney General at any uncontested hearing, at any hearing where a district attorney appears on behalf of state and positions of department and state are not in conflict, directs court to order reasonable continuance of hearing that was not initially contested, but that becomes contested to allow department time to obtain assistance of a district attorney or legal representation of Attorney General. This provision, as written, sunsets January 2nd, 2016. You do have a -2 amendment. The -2 amendment authorizes DHS to appear as party in juvenile court proceeding without appearance of Attorney General at any hearing held after the initial hearing request and any proceeding where district attorney appears on behalf of state and positions of department and state are not in conflict. There is an emergency clause with the amendment. You do have an hand-engrossed amendment in front of you along with a fiscal statement on the -2 amendment, and there is no revenue impact.
So with that, I'd like to call up Lois Day and Jessica Adamson. Should I call him up? And also Aaron Felton. Let's just get everybody up. Mrs. Day, would you like to start?
Yes, thank you. Chair Ho and members of the committee, my name is Lois Day. I'm the Child Welfare Director at the Department of Human Services. I'm here to speak in support of this bill. The House Bill 4156 is a time-limited statutory fix to allow legislators and stakeholders the opportunity to have a full conversation about the issue of legal representation of the department in these proceedings. ORS 9.320 requires the state to appear by attorney in all cases unless otherwise specifically provided by law. Historically, this statute has not been enforced in juvenile court, in juvenile dependency proceedings, and DHS currently appears without our counsel present in a number of hearings, but engages the representation of the Attorney General's office when needed. Recently, some judges have begun enforcing 9.320, requiring us to have an attorney with us at every hearing. And the department is not budgeted at the level which allows for that level of representation at this time. And if we are required to have attorneys with us in every hearing, it will result in some budgetary challenges from increased Attorney General fees. This bill provides the statutory exception required by ORS 9.320 to maintain the process as it is today. It is time limited. It will sunset in June 30th, 2015, but we feel that will provide the opportunity for full consideration of the options and implementation of a sustainable resolution. So I'm requesting the committee pass this bill and can answer any questions you may have.
Great. Ms. Adamson.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of Youth Rights and Justice. Youth Rights and Justice has represented over 50,000 youth in the child and dependency system since 1975. We completely agree with the goals of this legislation. As we were reviewing it, we had some concerns about unintended consequences. We very much appreciate the work of DHS, the Governor's Office, the Judicial Department, and the PDSC to fix the technical issues with this bill, and strongly urge you to adopt the -2 amendment and pass this bill, as it will do important things for DHS and make the system work better.
And I just want to say thank you very much for bringing up your concerns, helping us get an amendment that got this bill to a place where people could support it.
Thank you, Chair Hoyle, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Felton. I'm the district attorney for Polk County, and I initially signed up in opposition to the bill, mostly because I had some questions and concerns, and I can say that the -2 amendments address those concerns, and so I can now say with the -2s, I can support the bill. And so I'm grateful for talking with the community partners and stakeholders, and the -2s do address the concerns that I had. And I just will briefly say that they come from a small county perspective and financial concerns primarily. Polk County, we are a four-person office, four-prosecutor office for a 76,000-person county. So I would say we're probably, my own thumbnail sketch, the smallest prosecutor's office in terms of lawyers for that size of county. We've had to make some very difficult decisions recently in terms of restructuring. We've taken about a 30% hit in personnel in the past two or three budget cycles. We had a public safety levy not pass. You know, we're not alone in that. So I've had to make some difficult decisions from an administrative standpoint. One of the hardest decisions I've had to make is basically pulling out of representing DHS in dependency proceedings and asking the Department of Justice to come and step in. That decision is made easier by the fact is that there's very able counsel available from the Department of Justice to be there in court to assist in those matters. There's another statute just to be aware of as you're considering the bill is 8.685, which allows the circuit court to require the assistance of the district attorney's office to appear when DHS appears in juvenile court. I just wanted to be sure, and I've received assurances that DHS and DOJ, for that matter, intends to appear in all pre-adjudication appearances. And that's why I like the dash twos, because this bill now applies to post-adjudication, post-trial. And I think that's sensible. Basically, my understanding keeps things in the status quo, which is working well. And it doesn't apply to pre-adjudication, pre-trial processes where my office was involved. It's not a choice I would like to make. Funding of these matters, funding of public safety, that's, getting to be a longer list of issues. That's a larger conversation. So we'll get there. But I think the dash two for now keeps things the way they are. So I can support it from a small county perspective that's trying to do the best we can with what we have. Thank you.
And I think Lane County has some similar issues, and
happens,
so
yes.
We really, really appreciate the work that you do.
I've learned a great deal from Alex Gardner and how he's had to address those challenges as well.
Well, thank you. Any questions? Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming to testify today. Oh, wait. Stop.
And you can get back to me on this. Does the state, I don't know the answer to this, does the state reimburse district attorneys for their work done on child welfare and 419B cases?
I can answer that, Chair Hoyle, Representative Hicks. I can answer that question. There is a contract that is out there, that there is an offer made to the individual counties based on the formula that has created based on the number of cases and some other factors. I can tell you for Polk County, the amount that was offered was simply insubstantial. I was not able to accept the contract because it simply didn't amount to enough money for me to merit accepting the contract. I really need one FTE to get the job done. Again, that's a financing issue, and that's part of the larger discussion, what it would take. I won't quote a number here, but I'm thinking of a number, but it wasn't what was offered. It was basically a third of what I need to get the job done.
What I'm hearing is it's very conceivable that many offices, whether your size or otherwise, DA's offices are frankly subsidizing the state, potentially subsidizing the state in terms of not being reimbursed for the full value of the service they're providing in these 419B types of cases. It may be that if you'd have taken the contract, you would have been potentially subsidizing the state from your budget.
Chair Hoyle, Representative Hicks, that would be one way of looking at it.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Any other questions?
No questions, just a comment.
Okay.
I just can't stand this. Madam, those pesky judges who read the law and start enforcing it, that's a real problem. And we won't get into the larger discussion in this country about laws that we know about that we do not enforce. But I had to get that on the record because she said it.
Well, Madam Chair, this may be one of those obsolete laws we're facing.
All due respect, Representative Barnhart, we are not revisiting discussion.
That's the Senate.
That is not our issue anymore.
She's sitting right next to you. You should be careful.
Yeah. Okay.
We do in the morning, too.
We're going to close the public hearing on 4156, open up a work session on 4156. Thank you again for coming to testify.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 4156.
Vice Chair Holvey moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 4156. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4156 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hovey moves House Bill 4156 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the motion passes. Representative Hicks, would you like to carry that?
Okay.
Excellent. And close the work session on House Bill 4156. We'll be meeting on Friday. We'll be meeting on Friday at 3. See you then. We're adjourned. No, sorry. No, sorry.